my name's Lynn, and I'm an alcoholic. And you all have a glass of water here for me. That's very nice. Thank you very much. And thank you, Billy, for asking me to come out here. I can't tell you how happy I am to come through here, because I used to drive down Route 29 to visit my parents in Charlottesville. And many, many times it was with a glass of vodka in my hand. So it does bring up, not too many old memories, because I can't remember that much. But also, I got my first sober speeding ticket in Madison. I had 6 months of sobriety, and I was so excited. I wanted him to give me a breath test. You know, he wouldn't. But it was just a gift of sobriety to be pulled over and to be sober for me, because I'm an alcoholic that likes to drink and drive. And I did that a lot. But to start at the beginning, a little bit about my ism, my internal spiritual maladjustment is the way I like to look at it, is when I was a child, my parents discovered when I was 5 years old that I was totally deaf. Now, I had been totally deaf, but they never picked up on it because I had two older brothers. When they called us to supper, I followed them. You know, I followed their cues. And my parents were relieved to have one that didn't talk. So, they didn't pick up on it. A kindergarten teacher actually discovered this and told them I was deaf, and they, you know, took me to doctors, and they started this series of lots and lots of operations to restore hearing. And it took them till the third grade to actually restore hearing in one ear. And my deaf world was, to me, a wonderful world. As far as I was concerned, everybody was deaf. I can remember being at the Brownie Scout Troop at the nursing home at Christmas time singing Christmas carols, and we were all... And that's what everybody was doing as far as I was concerned. So when they finally restored hearing one ear, the first time that I got to hear, they'd done this operation and they took the packing out of my ear. And the first thing I could really hear was the doctor laying this metal instrument on the table, and it sounded like an explosion. It was just blam! And my mother started talking, and it was horrible. It was just, still a little rough, but we worked through that. But I just wanted her to stop. And they got me to calm down, and the real downfall for me came when they walked me outside and a car drove by and I threw up. I wanted to be deaf again. I mean, deafness gave me this gauze. And so, in the third grade, I needed a drink. Yeah. But I held out until I was 17 years old. And when I was 17, I had my first drink, and I knew a new freedom and a new happiness. You know, having a drink just put that gauze back around me. It was just what I needed, because being deaf in one ear, I just didn't quite fit in. Things were... Army brat, traveled around a lot. That didn't bother me that much. But it did bother me a lot when someone would be talking over here and I'd look this way and you could hear them laughing or, yelling or whatever it was. It was just never quite in sync with everybody else. And I took that drink and I was in sync. Now, the problem is, and when I took that first drink, I got drunk. Didn't intend to get drunk, but I got drunk. I blacked out. Didn't intend to do that. But that was okay. I threw up, too. And that was just part of the package. I grew up with a lot of drinking in my family, and the deal was that as long as you got up the next day and went to work, everything was just fine. And that's what I knew. And so for the next 25 years, I drank. Got up, went to work the next day. Now, the thing that I didn't put together until after I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous was that my decision-making skills went south when I started drinking. And I thought they were pretty good, but in retrospect, I guess it was not a good idea to marry the first guy that I met over a bottle of Boone's Farm apple wine, get drunk, throw up, marry him. You know, we got married, and that was a 6-year suicide pact. And it was definitely a mess. It was drinking all the way. It was all the joys that went along with that. There was physical abuse. But I was the one actually that held everything together. I was the one that got up and went to work the next day. He was the one that spent the paycheck, came home, did whatever it was he did. And I'm thinking, what am I doing wrong? How can I fix this? There must be some way of fixing this. And after 6 years, I knew that man was going to kill me. I just knew he was going to kill me after a couple of interesting episodes, one of which, the last one being, he tried to kill both of us in a speeding car heading for a tree. And I don't remember how I got out of that car. I wasn't drunk at that point, but I completely blacked out, and I don't remember anything from that except that I moved out. And in order to do that, I had to leave the God of my understanding. I'd been brought up in a Methodist church. I had sworn to God that I would honor and obey this man, that I would be with him forever, and I could not reconcile leaving him without leaving the God of my understanding. And so at that point, I said, I've made a big mistake. God put us on this earth with our wits and our wisdom. And he expects us to take care of ourselves, and maybe he'll get back to me later. You know, I just thought that God was supposed to help me, and I was clearly wrong about that. And so from that point on, I decided I was going to take care of things myself. So we had a lot of bills from this first marriage, and of course I was going to be the one to pay them. And I decided... another brilliant decision, that a very fast way to pay those bills off was to become a logger. It was convenient where I was living in the Connecticut, New York, Massachusetts area. The man that ran the logging company was delighted to have me because, you know, being a woman, I was a little more gentle with the equipment. And when he paid me on Friday, he could count on me showing up on Monday. I was always there on Monday, and we never knew about the rest of the camp who was going to be there. We were always scrambling to find people. So I operated a skidder. I operated a chainsaw. I cut down mighty big trees, and I started drinking in the morning, because that's what you do with heavy equipment, right? But I was not as bad as my boss. You know, my boss started at 7 in the morning. I didn't start till 10. So, you know, I was certainly much better than my boss. But I did, you know, the life of chaos that goes with a woman being a logger, it was all there. It was all there. But I did pay off those bills, and I thought at some point maybe I need to, you know, contribute something to life. And I thought maybe I'd go back to school. So what does an active alcoholic ex-logger do? Go to school to be a teacher. So I moved back to Louisiana, and I started going to school. And this is one of the things that about my alcoholism. I'm just one of those alcoholics that could get into these scrapes, dig her way out, and look, you know, at least in my perception, look pretty good. Everything's looking pretty good here. And I went back to school and got my bachelor's, my master's, and eventually my PhD, and also picked up husband number two over a bottle of Carlo Rossi. Threw up, married him. You know, that was how I operated, folks. And that was a 13-year suicide pact. It did produce two children. But that former relationship and that current relationship was alcohol driven all the way. That was what we knew. We were living in Louisiana at the time. You know, in Louisiana it's against the law to drink and drive, but they have these very convenient liquor stores that you can drive up to and get a big cup of jungle juice, and you can imagine what's in that, with a straw, and you can drive off. And that's what we did. That was our entertainment. That is what we did. And of course, my favorite drink was, what do you got? You know, what do you got? I drank everything, anything I could get my hands on. Beer, not a big fan of beer, but if that was the only thing that was on the table, I drank beer. Wine, you know, okay, whatever, but I really liked the liquor. You know, liquor's quicker. Never drank for the taste. I never drank for the taste. I drank for the gauze. I wanted the gauze. I just wanted something between me and you. And alcohol did that for me. It put something between me and you, and it was good. That's what I liked. But the disease progressed. We knew that alcohol was a problem in our lives. I got a job up here at a university in Washington, D.C., and we moved up here, and it was just getting worse. And we thought, well, maybe we both just need to quit drinking. And you see, my dad had quit about 15 years before that, and the way he quit was white knuckle. He said, you know, alcohol had him. He didn't have it. And so he quit. My mother, on the other hand, had been to a rehab. And she was in a rehab, and she was sober for 2 years. So with that sample pool of two, I decided that the way you quit is you white knuckle. Rehabs don't work. And so we both white knuckled. The husband lasted 30 days because I am so charming without my booze. And he took off to Louisiana and left me alone with these two boys. I was living in West Virginia, commuting into Washington, D.C. I lasted for 2 years, folks. But it was 2 years of absolute continuous anxiety attacks. I would be driving down 270. That's a sobriety test. And, driving down 270 and I'd have this anxiety attack. And I don't know if you've just put a plastic bag over your head. No, don't do that. But that's what it felt like. There was a plastic bag over my head and I could not catch my breath and I'd have to pull the car over and I'd have to just, I'm going to die. And oh no, there's that first breath. And oh, okay. It's okay. You can get in the car and you can go on and you can do what you got to do. And you know, folks, that lasted for 2 years and the commute was part of the problem. I got very sick and I decided to move on into DC and got a little basement, one-bedroom apartment. The boys got moved into the bedroom. I slept out in the main part of the apartment, picked up a glass of wine, and within a month, I was up to a bottle of vodka. Now, by the time I figured out in AA that AA works a lot better if you don't drink, I have a PhD, you know. I won't even tell you how long that took. I'll tell you that later. It took a while. I had already heard about the progression of alcoholism, how if you stop drinking, the disease progresses. And I can remember thinking when I had picked up that glass of wine and I was driving home and thinking, maybe I need to get a bottle, that there was something wrong with that. And then within a week, I'm up to the bottle of vodka and I knew alcohol had me. And it wasn't that it had me, it was just what I needed to cope. It's what I needed to take care of those boys. I'm a good mother. I got up every morning and I fixed those boys their breakfast and I made their lunch and I met with their teachers and I did their homework with them just as fast as we could so I could have my drink. You know, what I know now is I was not emotionally available to those kids. I was just not emotionally available to those kids. I'd take them out camping, but we went camping as long as Mama had her vodka. And, you know, I can remember my oldest son saying, Mom, can I have a drink of your tea? And no, honey, I've got a cold, you know, all that crap. And I'd be, you know, I used to drive down to Charlottesville to spend the night with my mom and dad. They actually lived in Crozet. And as the disease progressed, we could not spend the night anymore. I just, you know, it was a quick two-hour visit, got to go, start heading back, get something to drink to make it on the way back. All that just sort of happened. It happened, but it was okay because in order to survive, that's what I had to do. That's just what I had to do. Alcohol was my solution. It was how I could cope with those colleagues. It was how I could cope with the traffic. It was how I could pay those bills. It was just my answer to everything, and there were no other options for me. But from that time I picked up that glass of wine and that bottle of vodka 1 week later, for the next 5 years, I drank. I went to work, I drank, I quote-unquote took care of those kids, and the disease progressed. And I knew at some point that I was going to have to manage this a little bit better because I was waking up in the morning just sick, the vodka just coming out of your pores. Now, I'm drinking vodka because nobody can smell it, right? But I'm thinking that's not the case with me. And I'm thinking to myself, Lynn, if you could just drink just one big gulp, slurpy cup of vodka. Just keep it to one. And it never happened. I drank as much as I needed to black out and pass out. It just never happened. And then I thought to myself, okay, the boys are in elementary school. And I remember very clearly making this promise to myself that if I could just get them through college, then I can finish the job alcoholically. And that was my hope for the future. And we moved out to a house in Rockville. And my hope for the future developed a little hiccup in the form of a DWI. DWI. I mean, I'd never been in trouble with the law. Now, I drank and drove all the time, but I'd never gotten caught, you know, so I must be a good driver. Everything must be okay. And cuts on the wrist. I mean, just the shame was, you know, just pouring out faster than the vodka was, you know, out of my pores. And just, oh, God, I don't want anybody to know about this. The kids aren't going to find out. My parents aren't going to know about this. I wasn't even going to tell the neighbors about this. And I'm sitting in the police station. That was my bottom. That was it. I was done. I'm not touching another drink. 1 o'clock in the morning, I am done. I'm through. I got home and that lasted till about 10 o'clock that next morning. And I picked up a glass of wine. And I thought to myself, well, maybe it's just the drinking and the driving. You know, just don't drink and drive. And within a week, with this impending court date hanging over my head, I'm going to the Kmart with a glass of vodka in my hand. I mean, I have to spend a lot of time driving. I got to have my booze. And I'm looking in the rearview mirror and just wondering if the police are going to pull me over and get caught. And now you understand why I was just so happy when I was in Madison and they pulled me over at 6 months of sobriety. And I'm not drunk! I mean, that was just weighing on me. And the lawyer that I got that was going to get me off, because I'm an upstanding college professor and this is clearly a big mistake, I know this lawyer is going to get me off, said, you know, it would help if you went to AA meetings. And I said, not no, but hell no. I'm not doing that. Those people can't help me. You know, I know what alcoholism is, and they can't help me. I'm not going. And I did not go until I appeared in court, and the judge disagreed. He allowed us how I ought to visit with you all. He gave me a DUI. He reduced it to a DUI, gave me a PBJ, and sent me to AA, EIEIO. You know, I was mad. I said, why aren't they out there getting the real criminals? You know, and I got to go to AA. Well, you know, I follow the rules. So I found out that there was a little AA meeting that started at 7 o'clock in the morning, a little ways down from my house, and I said, nobody gets up at 7 in the morning to go to an AA meeting. So I know I'm going to go in there and there won't be anybody there. And I walked in, and there were 6 or 7 people there. And for some reason, when I walked through that door and sat in that meeting, still drinking, mind you, I had no intention, I couldn't stop, had no intention of stopping, I felt a sense of relief. I felt a sense of relief. And I know now, in retrospect, that I felt relief because y'all were talking about the very thing that I dreamed about 24/7. I mean, I planned my grocery list around the grocery stores, around the liquor stores. I couldn't talk to my colleagues about my drinking. I couldn't talk to my parents or my kids, and y'all were talking about it. So I could sit there and listen, and someone asked, what are you here for? And I said, well, it's a big mistake. I got a DWI, and I'll just be checking in for a year a couple of times a week. And, you know, I just drink a glass of wine or two, and they all keep coming back. You know, just, we're glad you're here. Keep coming back. And they nodded, and I said, well, that's nice. They're real nice here. And then the language of the heart started seeping in. I'd go to these meetings, and I started hearing them talk about their drinking. And they talked about hiding the liquor bottles in the, you know, you put 2 in recycling because the other 8 go in the black garbage bag. And I said, well, yeah. You know, of course you do that. I mean, you know, now I have to confess to you now, when I walk around the neighborhood, I do check the recycling out to see who's coming. You know, I think they're going to be here in just a couple of months, you know. You know, but, you know, yeah, you do that. And then somebody said, well, they bought their liquor store at Liquor Store A, and, you know, Leisure World on Monday, Paul's on Wednesday, and 355 on Friday. And I said, my God, they're following me. You know, and they talked about going to a party that's a drinking party. That November, I went to a Johnny Walker Black drinking party. Don't even like Johnny Walker Black, but, you know, it's free. You know, what do you got? I'll take it. And I had to have a few good stiff belts of tequila before I went to that party. And I had to make sure that that bottle was full enough for when I got back, because I knew there was not enough at that party. And y'all were talking about that, you know, and I'm just kind of shaking my head like, y'all are talking about it like it's not normal. And this is how I breathe. This is how I breathe. And the bottom happened for me on Christmas Day of 1997. And on that day, my parents got up very early in the morning and drove all the way to Washington, D.C. to visit me and the boys for Christmas. And they had to have gotten up early because they rolled into the house at 9 o'clock in the morning. And at 9:05, I'm looking at my watch and I'm saying, how can I get them out of here so I can drink? Now, that was autopilot for me. But the difference was, because of the meetings, because of the AA meetings, I knew as I was thinking that was insane. And I still could not stop it. I could not stop it. I had to get them out. You know, I fed them breakfast. Let's open our Christmas gifts. You know, Mom and Dad, you need to get out. You know, there's going to be a lot of traffic on Christmas Day. I had them out at 11 o'clock in the morning. They were at my house less time than they spent driving up to come see me. And when they left, I pulled out the bottle of vodka, and I was at that place of pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. I didn't know how to stop. I knew I couldn't live without it. I didn't know what to do. I drank for the next 3 days, and on December 28th, I had a full bottle of tequila sitting on the kitchen counter, and I finished off this bottle of vodka, and I looked at it, and I put that empty bottle of vodka and drained the bottle of vodka, put it in the garbage can, and standing here today, so far, that was my last drink. That was my last drink. I can't tell you why, because I was drunk at the time I made that decision. What I do know for sure is that from that moment on, I have just not picked up a drink. I just did not pick up a drink. That's what I know for sure. When I put that bottle down, no matter what, I just did not pick up. And I was going to go to my little group and tell them that I was an alcoholic, but an ice storm hit. So, and it closed down the roads. There was no traffic getting out. And so I detoxed myself in my kitchen, pacing back and forth, standing at the kitchen door, praying to, I don't know, you know, just help me, help me. I was saying, help me. I don't know who I was saying help me to at the time. Just help me, help me, help me. And on December 31st, I went to my little group and I said, yeah, all right, I'm an alcoholic. And they, really? No. They got out the where and when, and they said, oh, great, great. You know, yeah, we'll help you. You know, you don't have to go to just two meetings a week. Go to a meeting with us tonight. You can go to a meeting this afternoon with us. And I said, well, no, no, no. I mean, the Titanic had come out with Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet, and I really wanted to see the Titanic. And they said, well, go see the Titanic, and you can still go to a meeting. And I did. I did that. I went to see the Titanic, and I knew that I was in trouble that Christmas Eve when the boat was going down. And there's a scene, the boat's going down, and the architect of the ship is standing there at the mantle, and stuff as the boat is going down is falling off the mantle, and there's this drink. And I'm going, catch the drink, catch the drink. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, how could he not pick up the drink and drink it? And I actually went back to my group and said, look, if we were all on a boat going down, you drink, right? The bourbon's right there. Take a pop. Who's going to care? You know, and they all just keep coming back, keep coming back. It works if you work it. Somebody suggested I get a sponsor. I said, I have a mother. Thank you very much. No. Someone suggested taking a look at the steps, and I had already checked them out. There was a lot of duplication in there. They could be compressed to six. I had given the big book a scan. They said, take a look at the big book, and I'd given it a scan. And, you know, the gender bias in it is just huge, and grammatical errors, and just, I just knew that when I felt better, I could help you all. So I just said, you know, just stay back here, and when I feel better, I'll help you all. I'll help you all. And what happened to me was from the moment that I put that drink down, I was lost. I was completely lost. I went from going to the requisite two meetings a week to a meeting every day, and sometimes two meetings a day, because I wanted to drink and I didn't know what else to do except go to a meeting. And I started whining at the meetings about, you know, oh, great, I've traded one addiction for another. You know, I used to drink booze, now I'm going to these meetings. They keep coming back. You know, we'll love you till you can love yourself. And, you know, I just, oh, they don't get it. They just don't get it. And, you know, I got physically sober. Physically, I started to feel better, but my head was racing a mile a minute. I would sit in a meeting, and somebody would come up to the podium, and they'd go, I'm so-and-so, I'm an alcoholic. And I'd go, no, no, no. Sort of like y'all are doing for me right now, huh? Probably not. Someone else would come up to the podium and go, I'm so-and-so, I'm an alcoholic. And I go, you can see that one coming, bud. I mean, that's for real. You know, that basket would be going around, and I'd be watching. I'd go, who is minding the store here? No one is keeping track. I mean, people are putting stuff in, taking stuff out. I mean, they need my help here. You know, they're losing money, you know, and how are they paying for this room? And, you know, just going crazy, crazy, hanging on to the seat of my chair. And one day somebody walked in and said that a woman with 1 year of sobriety's 23-year-old son committed suicide. And I thought to myself, she drank. She drank. That's what I would do. If my children died, I'm done here. And they said no. They said the rooms of AA surrounded her. They scooped her up. Women slept with her for as long as she needed them to be with her to get through those first few days without picking up a drink. But this self-centered alcoholic was sitting in the chair, and I just thought to myself, all right, I guess I can not pick up a drink another day. And that was all I could do with that. That was the quality of my existence. That was the best that I could do. And I picked up a 30-day chip, and I said, you know, 2 months is not happening. Miserable. The semester had started, so it was better. I was going to work, but as soon as I pulled up to a stop sign, the only thing I'd think about was that glass of vodka in my hand, so I'd go to a meeting. But I'd go, and I'd feel a little better. And I could get through the next 24 hours. And then it was just repeat the process, weekends, go to two or three meetings just to get through the weekend. My first 13 days of sobriety, I went to meetings and watched 28 movies. I know because I had Blockbuster print the movies out. I don't even remember what the movies were. I had them print them out. And I would just sit there and just mad dog that TV, you know, till the next meeting. Just, you know, time to go to a meeting. And, you know, it started to get to be 3 months. And something happened to me along about the second month. Somebody walked up to me in a meeting and said, "Oh, we know who you are. You're the school teacher." And I thought, "Oh, crap. They're all talking about me. My name's going to be in the Washington Post. My colleagues will find out." And then I had this moment pass over me that there was nobody inside the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous or outside the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous that was working harder to kill me than I was working to kill myself. I knew I was the problem. And so I kind of came to an acceptance, but I just didn't know what to do. And when it got close to picking up that 90-day chip, I was in a third step meeting. And they were reading the third step out of the 12 and 12, and I'm just cooking, not happy, bad day at work. And people started to share, and then someone asked me to share. And I said, "You know, you all read the words, and they don't make any sense. You all talk, and it doesn't make any sense." I said, "The only thing that makes sense to me is your faces. And I'm looking around at these faces like I'm seeing y'all's faces. And there were these light beams coming out of people's eyes, this glow." And I said, "I understand that." And so I said, "The best thing I can do is just shut up." And what I meant was just shut up the noise inside my head. And for one brief millisecond, my head got quiet. And it was quiet enough for me to get reconnected with the higher power that I'd walked away from some 25 years before. I just felt something wash over me. It was nothing that anybody could observe, but I'm sitting in that chair, and I said, "You're there." And I felt, "I've always been here. I've always been here." And so I got up out of that meeting, and I walked out the hallway, and the sun was shining. Hallelujah, hallelujah, hallelujah. It felt like that for about 2 weeks, you know. And I knew I was going to get a sponsor. I was going to work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, not the six that Lynn thought would be a good idea. I was going to go back and read that big book, because my problem, folks, for that first 30 days of crispy, critter, dry, was I had an opinion. Everything that I listened to, everything that came out of your mouths, when I read the big book, I had an opinion. And I knew that what I needed to do was I needed to read the big book without an opinion. I needed to listen to a kind and loving woman without an opinion. I needed to do whatever you all told me to do. And that was the deal. When I walked out of that meeting, I said, "Whatever you want. Lynn's way's not working. If I don't do something different, I'm going to drink. And if I drink, I know I'm going to die." And so I just, formal terms of surrender. I thought maybe they'd ask for my checkbook and the firstborn. They could have the firstborn. But, you know, checkbook, they didn't. It was make a pot of coffee, put a dollar in the basket, reach out and help another alcoholic. Now, that one was a little hard for me, because I was kind of used to sitting in the back row like this. You know, just step away from the school teacher. You know, just stay back. Yeah. And finally, when my sponsor suggested that it might be nice to reach out and shake a woman. Now, one of the things I did do right away was she said, you know, "Well, just help out with some service." And so I would go to the coffee pot area, and I'd see it was a little messy, so I'd start to wipe it, and I'd look back to see if anybody was looking. Lynn's here wiping up the coffee. Anybody see this? You know, and just, but little by little, I realized that it was important to do this stuff without being seen. And one day there was a woman that had just come into the meeting for the first time. She was clearly new, and she was sitting by herself, and you could smell the fear You could smell the fear. And I sat next to her and I said, "You're afraid." And she said, "I really am." I said, "I was too." I said, "It's going to be okay." And at that moment, I understood the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I understood that my relief came when I reached out and I helped another alcoholic. That was the beginning for me. That was one of the other beginnings. There were a lot of beginnings for me. That was one of the other beginnings. That young woman hung in for a year and then went back out and her heart exploded with cocaine and alcohol. She didn't make it. One of the things that I learned early in the program was that we only have one day. And there were so many people, when I put my opinion down and I sat in a meeting and really took it in, there were so many people that shared these little nuggets, just these little gifts that would help me get through that day. And I embraced them and I loved them. And a lot of those people eventually went back out. A lot of people that I learned from went back out. But that did not make their message any less valuable to me. It did not make it any less valuable to me. It just meant that I needed to stick close in case they came back. Just in case they came back. And, when I had that spiritual moment, I started foaming at the mouth. I was going to work the 12 steps. I drug my sponsor through the 12 steps. I mean, I just was, you know, I have got to do this and I've got to do this now. I knew where the change was going to happen. It was going to happen in the 12 steps. And, I had a lot to do. I'd been drinking since I was 17. I still thought like a 17-year-old. And as I was working through those steps, that realization came to me that summer when I had 6 months of sobriety and the ex-husband came to pick up the two boys to take them to Louisiana for the summer. Now, that used to be my ticket to really drink. I mean, I drank a lot anyway, but boy, when those kids were gone, woohoo! I mean, I really drank. And so he picked them up and they got in the car and I'm standing in my youngest son's bedroom and I'm watching the car go down the road and I felt this wave of pain pass over me. My God, he's got the boys, and what am I going to do? And all of a sudden, I realized that what I was feeling was love for my child. And I knew then that I didn't know what feelings were. I drank those things away. I drank those things away, and I needed to hook up. I do that too. I needed to hook up with the woman of Alcoholics Anonymous and talk to them about what was going on inside. I've learned since then that sometimes the pain we feel is just nothing more than love. It's nothing more than love. And learned a lot from the women of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I really learned a lot from working the steps. You know, I did my first fourth step when I had about 7-8 months of sobriety and spent a couple of months really working them just as hard as I mean, just thinking about it, you know, resentments, fears, sex conduct, really kind of laid it out, you know, the three column, the whole bit. And I went back to my sponsor and I did a fifth step, and I'll never forget just telling her everything and just really feeling this real connection between us. It was a connection. Now, she was probably thinking about what we were going to have for dessert. But I was feeling this real connect. I mean, I was feeling some relief there. And I thought, okay, fourth and fifth. Fourth and fifth helped me to know who I am. It helped me to know that I was not the victim in the first marriage. You know, the first time he hit me, I was the victim. But the second time I stayed, I was the volunteer. And I was really able to clearly see what my part was in that marriage and in all the other mistakes that I made. And it was freeing because I could take responsibility for myself. Looking at that, I can take responsibility for myself. I don't have to repeat those mistakes anymore. And I walked away from that fifth step meeting and I went to bed and I said, boy, this is good. And I woke up the next morning and I was just as sick as I was the day before. You know, those defects were still there. Those fears were still there. And I said, oh, that's what 6 and 7 are about. You know, I had this colleague that just was the colleague from hell. Every time I saw her, you know, just this gut of fear would wrench right through me. And I'd done my fourth and fifth. I mean, I knew it was fear, self-centered fear, but I needed 6 and 7 to ask God to help me to remove that fear because I couldn't do it. You know, and was I entirely ready? You better believe it. You better believe it. You know, when I did that formal terms of surrender, I never looked back. I've been entirely ready ever since. And, I'd say that seven-step prayer, and one day she came walking, she turned the corner, and she came walking down the hall, and that fear wasn't there. It just wasn't there. And we've become pretty good colleagues. You know, all of my colleagues, they were jerks when I first got sober. And they're pretty nice now. I mean, go figure. Speaking of colleagues, when I surrendered, I had become chair of the department, actually, when I got the DWI. I had become chair of the department. So I'm now chair of this department, and I'm trying to navigate all of this. But it got better when I started working the steps and settling down. And I got a phone call from the woman that had been my office mate for 7 years. Her name was Hannah. She's a brilliant mathematician. And they had diagnosed her with colon cancer. And so what the Rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous taught me to do was not to make that about me. But what could I do to be there to help her? And over the next 2 years of my early recovery, I went to her to every went with her to every hospital that she went to. Of course, she had her family. She had a good support system. But I was always there, too, until 2 years later when she did die of that awful, awful disease. Her mother and her father and her husband and I were standing by her bedside, and her mother pushed me over and asked me to grab her hand. And the Rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous gave me the gift of holding her hand while she took her last breath. And I know I saw God in that moment. I knew that she had not died. She just left her. It was something that was personal to me. To me. And it was a gift of sobriety, and I was so grateful. I was truly so grateful. And I could not have done it without the Rooms of AA to help me navigate through that and to be of service to someone else. So, I get a little emotional when I think about that. She was a pain in the neck, really, a lot of times. But she was so brilliant. It was so funny. Near the end, when she died, she said, "Oh, Lynn, you know, you were such a good friend to me, and I've never been a good friend to you." And I said, "Of course you've been a friend to me, Hannah." And she said, "Oh, no, you joined the AA, and you never told me." All right. Fond memories. And so, you know, I continued to work the steps, 8 and 9. 8, I thought, you know, when I did the 4-step that 8 would be pretty easy, until I realized that there were people that needed to be on my 8-step list that, you know, I didn't have a resentment or a fear against, you know. So I had to really look at my character. And the nature of my wrongs. And as I looked at that, you know, more people surfaced that I needed to make amends to. And with the guidance, again, of a loving sponsor, who, by the way, after I had started that 9-step process with her, decided to pull back from AA. So I'd been through the 9 steps, and I was ready to start 10, 11, 12, and she was starting to separate from AA, and I tried to get her, you know, come with me to a meeting, and no, it's winter, I don't want to go out. And I knew that this was leaving me unsupervised, which is a bad thing for all of us, a very bad thing for all of us. And so I decided I'd better get another sponsor, and eventually my first sponsor did relapse. Now, just this past Saturday, she happened to come to the women's meeting that I go to, my home group. So I keep my fingers crossed. She's pretty miserable, but we'll see. My new sponsor is the antithesis of me. You know, they say, find someone who's like you. Forget that. Okay, find someone that will work the steps with you, that will call you on your stuff, that when you have a problem will refer you to the big book. Okay, that when you, you know, that will teach you to use the tools of the program, so that if they're not available, you can use your network or call upon your higher power. You have these tools that you can use. And so I had this woman. I picked this woman. I'm very linear in my thinking, very organized in my thinking. She's just sort of all over the place and just loving and kind. And, you know, she talks a little bit about, you know, how does your inner child feel? And I'm, oh, I just got such a... And so she's just perfect for me. Perfect. Just what I needed to sort of get, you know, some of my control stuff out of the way and, you know, feel feelings, for goodness sakes. 10, 11, 12. I like what Earl H. from California says about 10, 11, 12. 10, 11, 12 is me guiding you. you know, 10, you know, for me is 1 through 9 again. And I sometimes find myself cycling back 1 through 9. I just have to break them down because I'm a slippery little sucker. You know, and if I try to put it all into 10, I just may overlook what my part is in something. And 11 is a beautiful step for me. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God. What happened with 11 was I started, I was going to a meeting. It was an 11-step meeting. And I was sitting there, and I guess I had about 5 years of sobriety. And I'm listening to the people discuss the step, and I'm thinking, when's the last time you've improved your conscious contact with God? And I said, well, last 30 days? No. Last 3 months? No. I got to the last year and realized that, you know, God and I were just maintaining pretty much the same relationship we'd always had, and I knew I needed to do some work. And that's when I really started seeking out meditation. I started experimenting with meditation. I joined a women's meditation group, and then I ended up in another meditation thing. I developed my relationship through prayer, and in that journey, that exploration of meditation, my conscious contact with my God is becoming a real conscious contact. I'll never forget one day I was driving in the car and I said, oh, conscious contact. Conscious means when you're awake. Oh. You know, and just all these wonderful little insights start popping out. And so the 11th step is very meaningful for me. And it says, sought through prayer and meditation to improve. And I that's my barometer. Am I improving? Am I moving forward? And the 12th step, you know, the 12th step is that gift. It's that wonderful three-part gift. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. I started getting spotsies within my first year of sobriety. Had no idea what I was doing, but that's how I learned to become a good sponsor. You know, somebody says, you know, will you sponsor me? I say yes. And as I started growing with my sponsees, they would go through the steps. I'd have to go back through the steps. And in going back through the steps, the meaning became richer and more full. And just, you know, the steps have changed for me with all of my sponsees. My sponsees are my friends. I love them. They're my sisters in recovery. You know, we help each other. It's a peer relationship. But we use the big book. And we work the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Some of them laugh because they know. They already know when they call and they've got a little problem. I'll say, well, what step do you think will come in handy? And they'll come ready to talk about that. You know, what step do you think will work here? You know, the big book has so many of the answers when they call and they say they've got a resentment. You know, the answer is there, what, on page 67? Bottom page 67, and I'm not, you know, saying that to impress you or anything, but when you start getting all these sponsees and you're driving down the road trying to tell them what page to go to, you got to memorize them. You know, you can't look it up while you're driving. And so there it is. There's the answer to resentment. The long version is on page 452. You know, if you have real resentment, that's the get on your knees for 2 weeks and pray. And pray and let that one go. Beautiful resentment prayer on 452. And, you know, fears. What's the answer for fears? Well, is it because we trust ourselves rather than infinite God? You know, we don't apologize for our relationship with God. You know, and we trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. And, you know, in the sex conduct category, I'll never forget the line that I read. It talks about shaping a sound and sane ideal for our sex lives. And in fact, I think that translates for all parts of our lives, that this program is about shaping a sound and sane ideal for my life and in all of its areas. Well, so here I am. I had a year of sobriety, and I was feeling a little bit of loneliness, to backtrack a bit. And I was watching people get into relationships and things like that, and I'm thinking, you know, And in working my fourth, fifth, and my sixth, and my seventh, and realizing the type of character that I was, I knew that I was more inclined to go out and seek out exactly what I had sought out in the past if I did the seeking. So I said a prayer along about that ninth month of sobriety, and I said, God, you know, I don't know your will for me. I think maybe it's that you mean for me to be alone. And I'm good with it. I'm good with it. You know, I just want to be of service. You just tell me, and I'm good with it. And I meant it from the heart. I felt it from the heart. I was at peace. And I went through the Thanksgiving holidays and the Christmas holidays, and, you know, people were doing whatever it was they do, and I was good. I was completely at peace. And at 14 months of sobriety, this gentleman asked me out to dinner. And I thought he asked me out because he felt sorry for me because I wasn't dating anybody. But, you know, he said, no, let's go out to dinner. We went out to dinner. Had a very nice time. And, you know, first sober date. It was just a little bizarre. You know, I had to have the boys check, you know, am I dressed all right? Do I look okay? Is there lipstick on my teeth? You know, and just never cared when I was drinking. You know, that kind of thing when I was drinking. But, you know, just everything just so. And we went out to dinner. He actually was in the program, so we went to a meeting afterwards. And then he walked me home, walked me up to the stoop, and he leaned over and he gave me a little kiss, and I went upstairs and I threw up for 8 hours, and I married him. Some things never change. I mean, you know. So, you know, I thought, oh, he's got 7 years of sobriety. I've got 14 months. He's got all this sobriety. This is just so cool. When I got 7 years, I realized it wasn't that much. But the three most important words that the gentleman that's sitting over there said to me when we were starting to forge our relationship was not, I love you, but call your sponsor. Because I brought a lot of old ideas with me. Those old ideas were still there. And when I'm trying to navigate this new sober relationship, I mean, those old ideas are there. He said, call your sponsor. And that saved my bacon. I mean, my deal was to take a relationship and grind it in the dirt and then wash my hands of it. And it's through the steps that I learned to be responsible, somewhat mature in a relationship, and it's been absolutely wonderful. He's the best thing that could have ever happened to me, but I owe it to AA. There's no doubt in my mind I owe this to AA. My children grew up. They started to see the impact of AA on my life. They went to a lot of meetings with me. I had them go because I knew between their father and between me and our family heritage, I think I heard a tape the other day. They called it, they drew the black bean. They probably drew the black bean. I'd never heard that before, but the oldest one got married May the 9th and asked me to give him away. It was just, my heart still flutters when I think about it. The youngest one graduated, they both graduated from college, and I'm not killing myself. I got to watch them graduate from college and be a part of that wonderful event. The youngest one just discovered that he has Asperger's, which is a high-functioning form of autism. So he's learning to navigate that. And again, because of the principles of the program, the steps, and the kind and loving women that I have connected with, I've learned that I need to change how I communicate with this child. I mean, basically, his summation of how I talk to him is, Mom, you may say it's a suggestion, but it sounds like an order. And for an Asperger's child, I have to monitor and adjust and navigate how I speak to him. And we've just grown closer as a relationship of that. And so the oldest one is experimenting a little. He's finding his way. He has his own higher power, and I'm completely at peace with that. The youngest one has never touched a drink or a drug. So, you know, but who knows? Who knows? That's just where it is today. When I had my hearing restored, I so wanted to be deaf again. It was so horrible. It was so horrible. And I felt the same way when I got sober. When I got sober, that gauze was down. the gauze was down. And I wanted to drink again. I knew I would die if I did, but I wanted to drink again. And I'm so glad that today the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous surrounded me and covered me and loved me and carried me. But I'm also glad today that I took the actions that I needed to take to get sober. And those actions were to put my opinion down and to do what the sober people do. And today I go to 5 to 6 meetings a week. I have a women's home group that I belong to. I have a lot of sponsees. They're all very important to me. I love the work that I do in AA. And because of AA, I mean, a lot of people think, oh, she lives her life here, for God's sakes. You know, that's not true. I started golfing. You know, I always thought about golfing, but now I golf. Not well, but, you know, it does get in the fairway every now and then. You know, I decided to start practicing piano. And for about 3 years, I took piano lessons. I had to put it down because both my parents became ill. And now my parents are in a nursing facility nearby, and I'm able to suit up and show up and take care of them. And that's a gift of recovery. I've traveled. You know, when I was a logger out in Connecticut, I lived around history, early American history. You know, all around that area, Boston, you know, Vermont, New Hampshire. Never once went to see it. Never once went to see any of it. And today I go see places. We went out to Mount Perrier while we were here, Montpelier, James Madison's home. And we found out that alcoholism is not a new phenomenon. His stepson actually devastated his estate after he died by selling all of his furniture and his books to support his addiction to alcohol. So I heard that story and I just thought, well, there we go again. There we go again. And it just makes me ever so grateful for the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Makes me grateful for Billy, who calls me and says, would you come down here? Makes me grateful for the gift of service when I say, you know, yeah. I am so glad to be with you all. Thank you for letting me share.